coming through more and more now, that we're in the third week, that we can really see all the interlinkages between all the principles, which is really lovely to see it sort of naturally coming through. So I wonder whether we can maybe start the discussion. I'll maybe kick off with some of the issues that came through in the group I was facilitating, and then maybe the other facilitators can funnel some questions through. So one of the questions that we discussed in the group that I was in was, you know, do we, in terms of negotiations, do we really need to get agreement from everyone? You know, how do we deal with situations where there are disagreements despite a really sort of open and transparent communication, despite a high level of presence, etc.? How do we deal with these situations where there might remain some disagreements, and can we really enact interventions despite some level of disagreements? I'll pass over to you, Charu. Or do you want the second? Do you want the second part of the question as well? You're on the second part. Okay, great. So the second issue was linked to influence, and again influence, and again very closely linked to negotiations and this idea of agreements. Really, the idea of, okay, can we go through certain people or groups within the community who have more influence, in order to try and reach agreement and try and get interventions in place? Or is that actually something that we should try and avoid because there might be risks of favoritism, of maybe exacerbating relationships in the community, etc.?
Sure, thank you, Juliet. Hi, everyone. Pleasure to be able to join you all. They are great questions, and I think both of them are in some ways interlinked. Maybe the second one first. I think typically we tend to do just that. We tend to maybe go to the people with influence and talk to them and, you know, sort of take them along, get them on our side or on the side of conservation, and then we implement our programs. This is, of course, assuming that we've established a relationship with people. There's been a phase of trust building, and we've been present in the community for a while, and that really we are now at a stage of actually being able to discuss and negotiate actual interventions. Right, that's where we are at. And usually I think the danger is the other one, which is we only tend to interact with the more influential, the community leaders, etc., and not perhaps the, in some sense, the underdog. And I think that, it's not right or wrong, and it's not one way of doing things, but at least in terms of our experience, I think it goes a long way to make that extra effort to reach out to people, even before formal negotiations take place, to be able to reach out to people when we are ready to discuss interventions, to see what they feel about a specific, at that point, just an idea, to both leaders as well as, you know, the non-leaders as well. And sometimes great ideas come from, you know, the where you least expect it. And so I think just reaching out to people, it helps, in my experience at least, it helps both ways. One is it helps in building more support and ownership before actually getting to the stage of, you know, when there are formal negotiations and meetings and things like that. And also let's keep in mind that when there are formal interactions with communities, whoever is speaking, the leaders it might be or the others, they are not necessarily addressing us. They are not addressing necessarily only speaking to us or speaking on the issue, but they're addressing a much larger audience amongst their community, and they may end up saying things which perhaps they want their community members to hear, right? Not even if it is not, you know, being very supportive of our conservation interventions or our ideas. And therefore, I feel that it's always valuable to really, before we come to the next, I think the critical thing about negotiation, apart from the fact that they need to be respectful and empathetic, I think the timing is really critical. And so we should only get ourselves into a stage of negotiation after this period of trust building support, maybe even building support for an idea, for the intervention idea, getting people's inputs into it. And that way, when it's actually a stage of when we come to the negotiating table, as it were, then we sort of create broad, we would have created broad-based support already. Not just because we went out and reached out to people and discussed with them these ideas individually, but also perhaps because we've taken some ideas that people have provided, and it's good to be able to acknowledge that, the ideas that have actually come from people. And so already, even before an agreement, they are feeling a sense of ownership over the idea. So that's something I think really important to keep in mind. So, as far as the question of whether everyone agrees or not is concerned, now again here, it really depends. I feel it depends on the context. I mean, if it is something that really impacts the entire community, then it might be important to take along the last person as well. On the other hand, what we also have to realize is that, we can't force anybody, do we want the community to force anyone to start participating in the program, whatever, in the intervention, etc. And this needs to be dealt with, with a huge amount of patience, I feel. And there are times when you might want to go ahead, but clarifying that, not everybody is agreeing to this, but maybe we can start with a pilot in terms of the people who actually, the community members who are actually willing to experiment with us. And always clarifying that like nothing's written in stone. Even when we sign agreements, these are going to be broad guidelines, and we can revisit our agreements as we move forward. We can change them with mutual, discussion and consent. So people should not get the impression that they might get trapped into a particular, signing up for a particular intervention or a program. So there's a few of these related, I think, nuances which are good to keep in mind. I think it's always valuable. Of course, it's valuable to speak to the leaders. It's valuable to speak to people who may not be openly supportive, or whom we feel might be opposed to the idea for some reason or the other. Because if we can really go and talk to them and understand why they are opposed to a given idea, I think it becomes easier. So even to take them along, or at least to be able to understand where they are coming from. So a lot of this actually must happen, and ideally should happen, before we are on the negotiating table, and before we actually start talking about agreements and the nitty-gritty of a particular intervention. That's sort of my initial thought on this. But if there's any comments on this or further questions, maybe we can move the discussion forward.
Yes, any sort of first thoughts there on what Charu has shared? Otherwise, we do have another couple of questions that have come up in the chat.
Juliet, our group, someone asked about when negotiating, are there other examples of support when, someone might lose a lot of crop damage from wild boar or, livestock, and sometimes compensation isn't something you can put forward to negotiate. So they were wondering if other people had examples of other ways to find the natural interest to support them through this kind of conflict.
Justine, maybe here, when we're talking about negotiations, maybe at this point, maybe it's good to assume that there is already some the intervention that is sort of in general, we think we are ready to discuss a specific intervention and come to an agreement with the community. But what you are raising is a very important question, I think, but perhaps best done when we discuss responsiveness in terms of, you know, when a community is faced with a particular challenge, how do we respond to that? So I do not know if that those discussions have already taken place, but perhaps that's best, maybe not so much dealt with in negotiation or the negotiation strategy, but as part of responsiveness.
Okay, so we'll park that until next week. A really important question, so we will keep it, don't worry, Sherry. So there are a couple of questions that have come through the chat that are related to directly to negotiations and empathy, Sherry. The first one is around the importance of not just learning the interests of people that we're working with and then adapting changes to interventions to meet those interests, but also being transparent about our interests so that there are no expectations being raised on either side. So really that two-way sharing and actually how we get to those interests and needs. And then there's a second question, which I think is very relevant, around how we define a community. And the issue comes from a very specific example of the snow leopards being radio collared in a particular area. And is it sort of a problem if the whole community isn't aware of it? As in, you know, where do we put the bar, you know, in terms of communicating that to the community and how do we define that afterwards?
Sure. Sure, Juliet. I think that the you know, the first point about, you know, communicating our interests in addition to understanding the community's interests and individual interests within the community, I think that's a really critical point, because as all of us who have been involved in any level of community-based work, I think expectation management, it becomes a huge challenge, because for a variety of reasons. I mean, often we are working with really remote, far-flung communities who do not have, not always, but often they do not have access to, you know, various different kinds of facilities, resources, or, you know, different groups. And so when, you know, you sort of, because we are involved in that social work practice, people sort of look to us to be able to assist with various different issues, which may or may not be linked or have a direct bearing with conservation. And therefore, just being able to manage those expectations can really become a challenge. There are, and it's not just community level expectations, but also individual expectations. People come to us individually for help, and we do help people, we do help other, you know, them individually, etc. But it's a very hard balance to strike, because there's a huge number of people usually in a community. I'm not saying that, you know, they're always looking for help or whatever, but expectation management becomes a critical aspect of this. And here I think really that importance of transparency, of really sort of repeatedly, no amount of this is enough, you know, repeatedly, even with communities that, you know, we've worked for years, sometimes we have to reiterate what our fundamental goals and objectives are, in terms of course, being able to assist them, but ultimately it has to be linked to better outcomes for snow leopards and biodiversity. But I think that expectation management is very critical, and I completely agree that, you know, transparency and, you know, sort of communicating our interest repeatedly and emphatically, I think that's really critical. Yeah, defining a community, I think that's a subject I think we addressed earlier in bits as well. So I'll not repeat that in terms of how once generally we are, or the variable definitions of communities, but let's look at them really as a unit of people, or a group of people that we are actually able to engage with, who have some some decision making over the state of resources, how the resources, natural resources are to be used, or some kind of, if not, you know, legal, at least some usufruct rights over an area that is also important for conservation. And, but like Ajay and others will, and Deepshika and a lot of people who are involved in the field will be able to, I think, say this more emphatically than I am able to. I think that it's really helped us to be able to communicate to, you know, whenever we have communicated our whatever, you know, whether it's in this case video coloring perhaps, but even camera trapping, you know, the fact that we were doing camera trapping in an area. So getting the right, the permissions, but also communicating or finding ways to communicate this to the entire community. I think it's very valuable and extremely useful and perhaps also important from, in many cases, also from an ethical perspective, not just from a conservation outcome perspective.
Thank you, Cheru, and thank you for highlighting that last point as well of this ethical dimension, which I think comes through very clearly in the discussion around these two principles of negotiations and empathy. So there's another question that has come through from from Ajay around the well, Ajay, do you want to put that question to the group?
So while we spoke in our group, we were trying to speak about empathy and how one can build empathy, especially when we may not agree or there may be disagreements. And so our group began by saying that disagreements are likely to be things that come up. And over the course of that discussion, we went on to speak about the importance of being able to listen. And so, Juliet, I was wondering if we could speak a little about active listening and that the importance of active listening when we try and sort of engage with people.
thank you, Ajay. Cheru, do you want to start on that, or do you want me to start on that, or how do you want to do that?
Juliet, I'll let you handle the active listening bit. I think it's really important. I just wanted to just flag the fact that, you know, there will be always disagreements. And I think an important aspect of empathy here is to be really be able to understand from the other, the person who's disagreeing from their perspective, what their views are and where they're coming from and why the disagreement. Because, you know, those can maybe, if not provide ways of actually coming to an agreement, the least it can do is to help us sort of understand where they're coming from and not just view them as an impediment to whatever we're trying to do. But yeah, over to you, Juliet.
Yes, there's a very important point, which we covered a little bit in our breakout groups, but I always want more time to discuss them, never mind. So active listening, just a very quick aside then. Active listening is requires quite a bit more work than just listening. It requires quite a bit of concentration, it requires quite a bit of reflection, and also practicing active listening can really help improve the way in which you do that. And for me, the point of active listening is to really ensure that you are understanding and empathizing with others, because you're truly listening to what they have to say, and you're listening without any distraction, without hearing what you think people are saying, and also you're listening without immediately jumping to conclusions or thinking ahead about what you're going to reply. And these are things that we do very, very, very often. So when you're active listening, you're sort of creating a space, if you like, a really sort of clear space where you are fully concentrating on the person with whom you're talking, and you're providing that space for them to speak very openly to you, even on issues that can be quite sensitive. So there are quite a lot of ways in which you can really improve on your active listening. They are in the toolkit guidebook. I can't remember what we called it now, which we can share with you afterwards if we haven't done so already. But there are lots of things that you can do in terms of active listening. The most common one maybe is to ask open questions. So, you know, the questions that start with what, how, who, when, etc., so that you're not getting a yes or no answer. You can help in this active listening process by you know, rephrasing or summarizing what people have said, just to check that you're really listening to what they're saying and that you're not misinterpreting it or jumping to some sort of conclusion. So checking assumptions is always really, really key in that respect, just to really make sure that you've heard what they're saying to you. And it is fine in active listening as well to challenge, but in a really constructive manner. So you're not challenging just for the sake of winning an argument. It's really challenging to better understand people's perspective, etc. And so it's true that active listening is very closely linked to empathy, and it's something that that we don't just we're not just born with it. We have to practice it, and it is hard work, and it requires a huge amount of concentration, and it can be very tiring. Especially when you do it over quite a long period of time. So it's just something to be aware of as one way of really building that empathy and really hearing what the other person has to say, as Charu was mentioning. Right, so we've got another sort of quarter of an hour. Yes, and as Prowess just says now in the chat as well, really listening without prejudices. So it's being very open and not judging, but really just hearing other people without any sort of a priori around what they're saying. And it, as we said earlier in the discussion, it doesn't mean that we agree with everything they say. It just means that we hear where they're coming from. Yeah. Okay. We've got another sort of quarter of an hour of discussion. I think we've gone through the chat. Ah no, Ajay has come up with something. Ah yes, very important. Ajay, do you want to run us through your question?
So essentially, this was a question that came up in the feedback form that our participants had filled in. It was a very relevant one. Because we spoke about transparency and how to deal with it sensitively. And so this question, and now that we have Charu here, we were just wondering if Charu would also like to sort of come in on that. So the person who posed this question was saying that, I really would like to know more about sensitivity around transparency when we work with illegal activities like poaching and poachers are our target group. I'd like to raise this point to the group and hear others' experiences, if there are any, because it sometimes is really challenging to expect transparency and openness for target groups in decision making.
Yeah, thanks, such a complex question, of course. But before we try to sort of tackle that, I just wanted to add a couple of things to what you, Juliet, said, or in terms of both empathy and active listening. I just wanted to add that, you know, it's a lifelong learning for all of us. It's not like, you know, like we are sort of born with that empathy, or, you know, we're great active listeners or whatever. I struggle. It's a constant struggle for me to sort of try and be conscious of this and try to be more empathetic, and also try to be a better active listener. And so it's something that we all learn, or we can learn. Some people are already good at it. I certainly am not. So it's a constant learning exercise, and it's probably one of those lifelong ones. And I think there's always scope for improvements. I just wanted to add that, and, you know, it's not something that that we are born with necessarily. Not many of us anyway. But.
And sorry, just to follow up on that, Sherry, very quickly, on the topic of empathy, which is the same, right? I mean, it is very, it's not instinctive necessarily. It's quite hard sometimes to have that form of empathy. Do you, I mean, I was just wondering whether you could just elaborate a little bit on that, just it specifically in terms of the empathy aspect.
I mean, I've personally, you know, one of the really important ways of building empathy simply has been immersion in the community.
Yeah.
Just being present, spending time with the people, trying to understand, even, you know, to the extent is sort of allowed and not imposing. I think just observing, talking to people, trying to understand what they, not just what they do, but why they do it and why they make certain, you know, decisions and things like that. That's sort of been, you know, just ability to spend time with people out in the field has been huge in terms of helping build that empathy. I mean, obviously we're talking about empathy in general, but I think with the communities, it's both empathy and familiarity. You know, the more we understand them, the more we understand their practices, the way they use, why they do certain things, why they use certain resources, what's their decision-making body. I think all those things actually help build empathy as well. It's not just improve our knowledge or familiarity, but they do help, or at least I feel that they have helped me build that empathy. The other sort of related thing to empathy, and Juliet, I have not forgotten that other complex question, but just very quickly. The other important thing I think about what empathy teaches us is, I mean, for us, you know, we think, breathe conservation all the time, but, you know, it's not appropriate to expect our community partners to be able to do that constantly. I mean, for them, conservation may be an important aspect at times, sometimes very peripheral, and usually when it is important, it's in a negative sense, you know, it's in the sense of losing livestock or whatever. So I think that teaches us that recognition can only come by spending more time with people, looking at how they go on with their lives and face its challenges and so on. I think the what that does is a part of that, you know, an outcome of that empathy is it tends to make us more accommodating as conservationists, more patient, and more, in some sense, flexible. Otherwise, we are very good at sort of lecturing people about the rules and regulations and you should do this and you should not do this and things like that. But what that really does, that kind of reflection and empathy really helps us to become more accommodating. Sometimes things do go wrong. Sometimes, yes, people make mistakes just like we do. Or sometimes they don't take the sort of the fulfill their commitments as they have promised, just like sometimes we don't do either. So I always believe that, and also say it at times, that really community-based conservation needs to be done with a big heart. You cannot be too finicky about the little things about why didn't you do this properly, or why didn't you do this way or that way. I think there needs to be much more accommodation from community side as well, particularly from side of the conservationists. So I just wanted to just mention that because I personally, I think it's important to keep in mind. Ajay, I do not understand the full background to the question. I think it could be multiple things, right? One is about trying to get information or doing research on stuff that is illegal, poaching or just subsistence hunting, but still illegal in some ways. Is it about the research aspect? Because if it is, or is it about actual conservation work? Because if we're talking about conservation work, I think I would rather view that as something under the purview of law enforcement rather than community-based conservation. I think in community-based conservation, to address a problem like this, you still, I think, trying to build that trust, trying to understand, for example, why people do what they do, why, what are the why that hunting is happening. Are there ways, are there alternatives that one could assist the people with? So it's sort of a slightly different kind of, it's related, but it's a slightly different approach compared to if you were wanting to really be doing undercover work, you know, which could then eventually assist law enforcement. And that is probably not, does not come in the purview of this. And I think it would be dangerous to mix the two. You know, undercover law enforcement work, let's not mix that up with community-based conservation is would be my suggestion. Important though it is, but it needs a different approach. On the community side, yes, for sure, if there are, you know, if better research and familiarity, et cetera, can show us what we could do or perhaps lead us to potential collaborative interventions with the community, which would address issues of poaching and illegal wildlife trade, certainly. But then that is not, we're not going to achieve much by concealing information, I think, if that is our objective. But really, if the objective is undercover work and gathering intelligence on community, that's perhaps best kept outside of the purview of community-based conservation work, because they're very different things and trying to combine them will lead to disaster, is my feeling.
Ajay, did you want to build on that or are we all right?
No, I think the way it was posed was that clarity was not there, but I think Charu, what you have mentioned is put it in a very nice context, that context makes it important. And if I can take that a little further, if as a researcher, one is to sort of get into a landscape and trying to, you know, look at these kind of challenges, what would your sense be in terms of transparency and how do we build that into the way in which we go about conducting such research?
Oh, yeah, again, I think Ajay, from a research perspective, again, research is not undercover work. Research is not intelligence gathering. So I think research ethics become extremely critical in such a case. Making sure that nobody is sort of either tricked into providing us information or forced or coerced into providing us information, making sure that we have the nature of our permits is such that if we are able to collect sensitive information, that it can still be sort of, I don't know, made homogenized or made sort of but basically remove the identity of the person, do away with the identity of the people, because it is sensitive, it can get people into trouble, etc. So there's a lot of individual privacy as well as permissions, both at the whatever research permit providing authority level, research ethics level, at the level of the community and at the level of the individual interviewee. I think it's important to be able to provide that information and to provide all our information and intent transparently. And then, you know, having done that, if somebody is willing to still talk to us, we collect the data. But I think it would be very dangerous to try and completely unethical from a research perspective to try and trick people into providing us information. But Juliet, I mean, what your thoughts on this?
Yes, no, I think that's perfect. Thank you very much, Charu, for that. We have one comment from Niloufar. So I don't know whether she would like to take the floor and ask the question directly to Charu.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. Thanks, Charu, for your explanation. It was great to hear from you. I just wanted to say one of my experiences during a project. Just share this experience. Our colleagues have been working in Golestan National Park with poachers for so many years. So they were trying to encourage the poachers to actually achieve alternative sustainable livelihoods instead of poaching on wild prey of the Persian leopard in Golestan National Park. And all of these being among community, being present and everything had actually led to a great trust between our colleagues who've been working there and the poachers. So they usually came to our colleagues and talk about what they are doing inside the park, or even if they had poached an animal very recently. So it was a great achievement to actually receiving this transparency and openness. But at the at later phase of project, we decided to do a research on estimating the population of Persian leopards. So we set the camera traps inside the park, and we had some bycatch footage of poachers inside the park. At this stage, actually something happened really unexpectedly, that the DOE, Department of Environment, asked us to provide them with the photos and footages of the poachers to identify them and arrest them. So this was a really great dilemma for us, that if we wanted to not sharing the photos with the Department of Environment, we couldn't actually continue the research, we couldn't do the rest of the project inside the national park and other interventions. And at the same time, we didn't really want to break the trust between the poachers, which actually had been had to, like, so many years to make that. So I just wanted to share this experience as something happened to us, and it was really, really hard to decide that what should we do now? Should we actually talk about this issue with poachers, or probably say them that, okay, we got some camera traps inside the park. It's probable that it takes photos of you when you are inside the park, or whatever, just warn them about that, or no, just like go to DOE and share the photos without considering the consequences. So it was really hard, and this experience actually happens sometimes when you do research or conservation inside an area, and this is why I was really concerned about this transparency and how should we make trust being among the community. So I just wanted to share that if anyone else has any other experiences, or maybe Charu or you, Juliet.
Thank you, Niloufar. That's very topical and something that I know Charu has been working on very recently. So I'll just hand over to you, Charu, maybe to briefly comment on that before we have some maybe final thoughts from you on the two principles.
Sure, sure, Juliet. Thank you so much, Niloufar. That's such a powerful example of the kind of dilemmas we often face, both as conservationists and as researchers. It's like, it's hard. I mean, there's one thing I can definitely say is that we need, when it comes to the ethics and research ethics and so on, we need more work here. And interestingly, some of us, Juliet and Justine and Ajay and a few other colleagues, we've actually just written up an article, a paper. Juliet, by the way, it has come back with some very minor revision now, so just today. So, Niloufar, we've actually brought up some of these issues in a paper about the need for a better ethical standards for camera trapping work. And the subject actually we've tried to address there is exactly what you're saying. You know, when we capture human images on camera traps, often they are images of poachers, et cetera. So how do we deal with it as researchers and as conservationists? And we'd be, you know, just give us a few weeks, we'll share that with you. It doesn't provide solutions for sure, but it definitely provides a fodder for thinking and, you know, what we could do. And one of the important things there is that there's a lot of things we need to do in advance before we actually put out the camera traps and before the data come in and things. There's a lot of stuff to be done at that stage, and a lot of stuff that we have suggested should get done when those data come in. And some of these aspects, like, for example, if you suspect that the government might ask you, or enforcement agencies might ask or force you to share those data, then I think the communities need to know that. Just like, it's just like, you know, walking into a place which is, let's say, under CCTV footage, CCTV coverage, we expect to be informed, whether it's an elevator, a common space or whatever, we expect to be informed that we are under surveillance, CCTV surveillance, similarly with communities. But it's a really, really serious and important question. And hopefully, Nilofer, once that paper gets published, we should be in a position to share with you very soon, actually, hopefully. Thanks for bringing that up. It's a great example and really fascinating to hear about your work in Golestan, and I'd love to visit you sometime and see some of your leopards there. I think the other important thing that one of the principles that related to this aspect is the strategic support, which we will come to, working with governments, not necessarily for the sake of working with governments for our other means, but working with governments also for the sake of community-based conservation. And that's, I guess, a future principle that we will discuss, and perhaps, some of these things might get discussed there again as well. Juliet, I think everything got covered from whatever I gathered from the discussions. I would just sort of reiterate a thing or two that I have said earlier, like empathy, critical. I think critical for, in general, right, life, but generally, I think community-based conservation in terms of how effective we can be, and how effective we can be is largely going to be determined by how we can view the world from our community partners' perspective, or how well we can view the world from their perspectives as well, not just from ours as conservationists. And as far as the and that recognition that, we expect people to do things, we are expected to do things, we don't always do it, and we have inertia, people have inertia, and therefore we must be more accommodating than we often are when it comes to working with communities. As far as negotiations are concerned, I think that, I think it's such a huge subject in itself that I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but really to reemphasize the point that that timing is critical, and we should not, be at the negotiating table in a hurry. Need to create the right kind of conditions for those negotiations. A lot of work must happen before we are at the negotiating table. I think those are the two thoughts that I would like to leave you with.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Sherry. I think I would like to just add one more, because you said a really wonderful phrase earlier, when you said community-based conservation needs to be done with a big heart. And I think that was, for me, that was very, I'd never thought about it in that way, but it's completely right. And I think that a lot of our discussions today went in that way. And I really appreciate you highlighting that aspect, and also this idea that it really does teach us, this empathy and this immersion and presence and all that teaches us a number of different things, including patience, flexibility, being more accommodating, etc. So it can help, it can really help us grow as well as people in conservation. So thank you very much for that. So I think we'll wrap up now. I know that there are a couple of comments that have come in, but very linked to this camera trapping issue. So maybe we can share that paper in a few weeks' time, and maybe follow up with any other questions at a later date on that specific point. But I think I would like to close there for the session today. So as Charu mentioned, next week will be our last session. Unfortunately, it's going very fast, and we'll be covering responsiveness and strategic support. So the last two principles in the partner's wheel. It would be great if as many of you as possible could fill out our feedback form that we'll be sending at the end of this session. just to know whether the format is working or whether you have any other suggestions, etc. And please do send us your questions or your thoughts before next week, so that we can pick those up as well in the recap of the session that we start next week. So I think that's it from me. Justine and Ajay, was there anything else I failed to mention?